Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. You are live on Teachers Talk Radio. This morning, I've got academic co-founder and chief analyst at TeacherTap, as well as a speaker, author, tweeter, and general edu geek, Professor Becky Allen. We are live on Teachers Talk Radio. We are discussing education fads and much, much more.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Becky. How are you this morning?
I'm really good. I'm excited to be here on this radio show. I love your jingles. They're great.
Can you hear how pumped I am about this show in my voice?
Let's hope I don't disappoint you.
Listen, before we crack on with the interview, I normally do a spiel about how what I'm doing and all that kind of jazz and how the week's been. So how's your week been before I say how my week's been and what I've been up to?
I woke up this morning and I thought it was Friday and I was really happy for a while, but it's still Thursday, isn't it? My week's been fine. I have two kids at primary school. So, a lot of the week revolves around getting them to school, working madly whilst they're at school and then picking them up at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're, so according to your bio, correct me if I'm wrong, you kind of work at or with a university as well as with TeacherTap. Would that be right?
That's right. So I do a day a week at the University of Brighton where I'm mostly doing research but do a little bit of teaching too. And then the rest of the time I'm working at TeacherTap with Laura McNerney, and I'm the chief analyst there, so mostly crunching data.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, because I'm intrigued by this kind of TeacherTap analyst role, what is that? For people who don't know what TeacherTap is, say what that is. But then what I'm interested in is the role of analyst, what that involves.
So TeacherTap is a daily survey app for teachers that Laura and I started back in 2017 now. So really quite a long time ago. And we have thousands of teachers on the app answering questions every day for us. So all that happens is the app buzzes at 3:30 each day. And when you're ready, we ask you to answer three questions. And they're three questions about your day, what you've been doing in the classroom or in your school, or they're questions about what you think about education policy or perhaps how something works in your school. And we started it just because we just felt that there was often quite a false narrative about the way schools were and about what was going on in schools. And it was quite easy for politicians and indeed for researchers to stand up and say teachers are like this or teachers think this. And we used to sit there watching that thinking, do we know that? Do we really know that that's what teachers think? And the nice thing about TeacherTap is that anytime a politician stands up and makes an announcement at 3:30, we can ask teachers what they think of it straight away, and we can get really really quick feedback into the world about what's going on in schools.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what about being an analyst for them? What does that involve? Give me your typical process of work. What would it be?
So we have some routine things that we're doing all the time because we're always writing blogs to tell teachers how they responded to questions, where we're able to break down the findings by, for example, the type of job you're doing or subject you're teaching or phase you're in. So we've always got that going on every week. At any point in time, we've got different bigger research projects running. So at the moment, we're trying to look at what the state of, I suppose, teacher recruitment and retention is, particularly post-COVID lockdown. So we'll be publishing on that in 2 or 3 weeks' time. So there's these bigger things. And then because it's a business, there's kind of bigger technical challenges that we have that we just have to sort out. One of the things as the analyst is that we're always working really hard to make sure that our findings are representative of teachers across the whole population. so that we know what teachers are like across England, because we have a school workforce census. So we are constantly trying to create what they're known as sample weights to ensure that the responses you give are balanced, to make sure our sample represents the population.
Got you. And I know it's incredibly popular, you know, amongst teachers, and you can see that on social media in terms of the impact that it's had, and you know, and how it's, I guess, broadened the debate in many respects, because it is kind of a window into debating things. So in that sense, yeah.
It's also made the debate more complex, because it stops people saying teachers are like this. You know, the reality is it's a very diverse profession, and teachers have very diverse beliefs and daily practices and ideas about how they think school should be run. And a lot of what we do is constantly, you know, talk about the diversity of the profession. And that has big implications for policy, because it's hard to get policy to work in a profession that's very diverse and is not particularly amenable to having big ideas imposed onto it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that leads me on quite nicely to one of the things I want to talk to you about, which is this idea of teacher diversity, which is something you've written recently about in a blog, but I know it's included in your upcoming book, which is called The Next Big Thing in School Improvement, which we're going to dig into during this interview this morning. But this idea of kind of, you mentioned that, like, teacher diversity, or teachers being different and it being more nuanced and so on. But also you've related it, I guess, to kind of teaching style, teaching pedagogy, teaching in that sense. So what do you mean by this? Like, this idea of teacher diversity, and why did you feel exercised to write that blog and to include that theme into your book?
We wanted to write about teacher diversity in the book because I think it's a really important part of making sense of why it's difficult to improve schools, and why it's difficult to make education policy. And what we mean by diversity is that teachers are very different to each other in their beliefs about what teaching is and should be, and what schools are for, in their motivations for wanting to become teachers, but really most importantly, in their instructional practice, so the ways that they choose to behave in the classroom each day. And in the book, I suppose, we talk a little bit about why we think that that happens. And to some extent, it happens almost more than in other professions. We don't have a very strict code of how teachers should behave in the classroom. We say one of the reasons it's actually able to happen is it's very difficult for us to know what works and what constitutes effective practice in schools. And maybe we'll talk about that later. But also because teachers are relatively isolated in the ways that they do their jobs compared to other professionals. You tend to work on your own inside a classroom without contact with other teachers. So it's perfectly possible for different types of practice to develop and persist within schools and to sit really quite happily amongst each other. But it does have important implications, I think. Particularly for school leaders who are trying to lead schools and they want to affect change in their school and have this natural urge to try and impose order and to try and reduce the amount of diversity that there is. And for, you know, researchers, you kind of have this belief that there must be some sort of scientific right way to do things in schools. And if only we could discover it, then surely, you know, teachers should all become the same in what they do.
Do some people already think they've discovered that, though? The best way to do things?
I think some people have strong ideas about the way to do things, but when you really unpack what they are, I don't think that they are a complete roadmap for how to teach. You may be, for example, particularly enamored by particular aspects of cognitive science that are coming out at the moment and be quite systematic in the way that you believe teachers should incorporate particular types of approaches into their lessons or their design of curricula. But actually, you could do that and still see a lot of diversity in the way that teachers choose to teach. So at any point in time, we have particular elements of the teacher's job that we try to clamp down on and enforce alignment. I mean, when I trained to teach, you know, it was absolutely the done thing that your lesson must have three parts. It must have a starter, it must have a main part, it must have a plenary. You remember that, you know, and that was an example of us deciding there is such a thing as good practice. But actually with it, you know, it wasn't evidence-based. And within it, you could do all kinds of, you know, things that you wanted to. And nobody ever got round to the plenary, did they, in any case, because you were out of time.
Well, I will tell you a story, Becky, that I, in my, I think this would have been like my second year maybe in teaching, 2008 kind of period, when a lot of that era of like the 3-part lesson, 4-part lesson was very much on trend, right? And a kind of external consultant / inspector came in and he observed my lesson. And at the end of the feedback, he's like, oh, that would have been brilliant, but you didn't do a plenary. So therefore it cannot be above a grade 3. It cannot be above satisfactory in the old, you know, yeah, grades. So that kind of, I mean, would you describe that idea of the 3-part, 4-part lesson as a fad? Or, because in my head, you know, what I tended to do over time is I actually think though that if you imagine like the 4-part lesson, right, I actually imagine that those elements are actually pretty good components. I think the issue was trying to put it inside a single lesson and then to actually measure teachers on it rather than the components themselves, you know, like connecting, I think it was like activation, demonstration, consolidation. I mean, these elements are things that kind of just a good teaching, right? But it's the way it was packaged up.
Yeah, well, the things you've just mentioned, the ideas of connection and activation and other things, these are kind of what we think of as like metaphors for us trying to describe how we think that children learn. And one of the dilemmas we have as a profession is that we don't really know what change we're trying to affect in a child's brain when we're teaching any particular thing. So, for example, if we're trying to teach children and to develop an understanding of what, I don't know, magnetic energy is or something like that, you know, we don't know what neurons we're trying to connect. We can never see them. There's no possibility of them ever seeing, of us ever seeing them. So we construct metaphors that we think are good working models for what we think we're trying to do in the brain. And we have to do that. And I think that some of those ideas are useful and are good ideas, but I contrast between trying to do that and then saying there should be a starter and a main part and a plenary, which I don't think are trying to construct metaphors for the act of learning and trying to map them onto the process of the lesson. I mean, the reality of the starter is that it could be useful, it could not be useful, it could be some retrieval practice from the last lesson, it could be some, you know, it could be something completely different, it could be anything. So those kind of concepts aren't really linked to our struggle to try and build kind of consistency in our ideas about how children learn.
But just coming back to this idea of this like teacher diversity in I'm guessing what you mean is diversity in pedagogy. That surely is a key element of that, is what you're saying. Or I mean, are you basically saying there isn't necessarily a best way, or are you saying there is a best way, but there's broad remits within that way?
I think we're saying that there's a lot of consistency. The more we learn about how children learn, the more we learn there's really quite a lot of consistency in how children learn. And therefore, the idea that teachers need to adapt to their local context or the exact children they're teaching isn't probably that important. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there needs to be alignment and consistency in how teachers teach. And in part, that's because, well, we don't really know at the moment exactly what we should be telling teachers to do. Yeah. But also, teachers are very unique and different to each other in their talents, their personality, the types of techniques that they've learned to do and have become embedded as habits. And largely, we need to work with who teachers are and how they enjoy teaching and how they like to teach, and then make marginal changes on there to make sure that their own teaching practice is more effective, rather than try to, you know, on a whole scale basis kind of disrupt what teachers are like.
Yeah, because I mean, the reason I'm getting at that, I guess, is because there are schools and academy chains and whatever who would be very, very strict on that. They probably wouldn't encourage teacher diversity in any respect.
And I've seen those schools, and some of them I really like, and some of them I look at what's going on and think this is absolutely crazy. You know, I visited a multi-academy trust where all teaching had to take place with children on tables in groups. And this was a secondary school. You couldn't have them in rows. You couldn't have them facing the front. With certain elements of group activities that had to take place every single lesson, so that the children were supporting each other. You know, that's fine if that works for your subject, it works for the topics you're teaching, and it's a way that you enjoy facilitating your class. But there were teachers in that school who would talk about how difficult they found this. You just kind of think, this is crazy. Why do you need that kind of order and alignment within a school? Why is it not okay that in some lessons kids walk into the classroom and there are rows and they're taught in a particular way, and in other lessons they're taught in another way?
Did you ask them why?
I asked the teachers why. I didn't ask the head of the multi-academy trust. I've been, you know, I've been to Michaela like other people, which is perhaps one of the, you know, most extreme examples of alignment taking place within a school. But that's a very unusual school, because it's a free school that only recruits teachers that really want to teach there in that particular style. So having alignment where the teachers are actively buying into it is absolutely fine.
So I mean, bloody hell, I'm interested in this this idea of you kind of walking in and seeing this, because I spoke up to Guy Claxton actually about this, and he was on this show a few months back, and he was, I don't want to quote him on this because I'd have to listen back to exactly what he said, but he was saying that the kind of teaching oracle, the kind of teaching aspiration is to have that style, you know, where you've got the table and they're sat in groups and there's collaboration and so on. But to be able to get there, you know, it is very difficult with teenagers and the way classrooms are. They're packed, they're crowded, you know, 30 plus students, behavior, you know, and all the rest of it. But he was saying that's what we should almost aim for, is that kind of model of collaboration, group work, you know, kids sat together on tables and that sort of thing. I wondered whether you think that's because the thing is, in some ways, he's probably got a point there. He's probably onto something there. Because if you look at, like, offices, right, like, I don't know, Google or something, they're probably, like, they've probably got lots of, like, things where they, let's go to a collaborative space and let's, like, discuss our ideas and brainstorm and come up with the next big thing. Do you see what I mean? Like, there's probably a lot of that going on. I'm just wondering whether, because we're working with big classes of teenagers and big classes of kids, that isn't necessarily the best way in that context. Do you see what I mean?
Well, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, I'm just throwing. I mean, I'm throwing ideas at you, Evan. I'm just throwing ideas at you.
There's the trivial thing to say, which is, well, it may well be an aspiration. That's very interesting, but welcome to the real world. We're not about to transform society and the behavior of kids. Therefore, forget it. Like, if you don't want to teach with your kids in tables, chatting away and interacting with each other, then you shouldn't be forced to do it if it's going to be difficult for you to manage. But more importantly, suppose that behavior's fixed. And a good way to think about this is, I think, you know, the teaching I do nowadays is grown-ups, mostly on master's courses.
Well, I was going to say.
Small classes, you know, big rooms, small classes, highly motivated.
Yeah.
Do I have them sitting there doing lots of interactive group work? Or do I have them sitting just facing me working on their own? You know, the answer is it depends. Like, it depends what I'm teaching them. If I'm doing lab work where we're trying to learn how to use different statistical software or very technical things, the last thing I want is them interacting and collaborating with each other. Like, they need to work through exercises and learn how to do things. And there's loads of circumstances where the most productive learning environment is the person sitting on their own, facing the internal challenge of working on a task by themselves. And then just to switch across to Google and Open Plan, like, Tom, I don't know whether you've actually like tried to work in an open plan office. I mean, it's absolutely terrible. You know, part of the reason so many of us in the type of work we do love working at home so much is that it's not disruptive. Because, I mean, I think when people talk about creative environments, they talk about not, they're not being collaboration, but in fact, the most creative environments are where people come together, they have a conversation to specify, you know, what a challenge is and to define terms, but they go away and they spend time on a lot of time on their own. In fact, the vast majority of time on their own before they then get together at the end and share ideas and work them up into something.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine my year eights in an open plan office, I have to say, it'd be something to behold. But I think you mentioned something there in terms of behavior, if behavior's fixed, and that's exactly it. I mean, for me, if I knew when I was walking into a classroom with teenagers, look, you're not going to have any sort of, you know, behavior issue to deal with here, and I knew that in advance, I'd probably teach in a different way. But if that, does that make me bad? Because surely I should be aiming to teach in the best way that I genuinely believe is the best way, or based on, you know, well, I was going to say based on research, but you take my point. Based on what I think's best, right?
No, it's not about you. It's about the kids and creating a situation where they can learn effectively. And it may mean it's compromising your teaching style or whatever else, you know, but let me just say this, and I feel this acutely now, I have children who talk about what goes on in the classroom. Even for a teacher in a classroom with lovely top set kids who are really nice and sweet and everything seems really nice and they're just chatting and murmuring away, we know that they are disrupting each other because they're chatting about what happened in the playground and friendship issues and everything else. Or, you know, the kids who constantly asking to borrow pens, they don't know what they're doing, can you help? And, you know, my daughter who
you haven't been watching me teach, have you?
But my daughter who's now 10 said one of the greatest things about lockdown learning, you know, learning at home, what was that she wasn't disrupted all the time. And she's in a, you know, lovely leafy school where there's not behavior problems, but she is constantly disrupted in the classroom because you are, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you've got to adapt. You know, you can't stand still. You've got to think on your feet. Right, what's the best thing for me to do in this situation? That's why I don't think, and I want to get into the book, right? I want to get into what the chapters of the book are, because the book's called The Next Big Thing in School Improvement, right? Mm-hmm. That sent chills down my spine, by the way, in a good way. But The Next Big Thing in School Improvement. So I want to know what the chapters are and how you decided what the chapters would be. And I've seen, you know, fads is a word I've seen used in the kind of description for the book and everything else. What are the fads that you're covering here? What are the things that you're saying? What is the next big thing in school improvement?
Well, I mean, I think the title is somewhat ironic.
I was going to say, but I wasn't sure.
It's not the next big thing in school improvement.
Yeah.
We came together, the three of us, through a frustration with the narrative around who schools are and how they improve. From various different perspectives. So Ben, you know, as a jobbing classroom teacher, was just really frustrated by the crazy things he was being asked to do.
Yeah.
And that was really within the data fad, which maybe we'll talk about.
Yes, please.
But rather than, he was mostly just trying to critique them and say, look, these were statistically illiterate ideas and none of us should have been doing it. It was a waste of time. But he was also just trying to get to grips with but what has led people to start telling teachers they should be doing these things. And I suppose I was kind of jaded by the data era too, and thinking about things as a researcher and from the perspective of big policy and trying to watch policy being made and think, why does bad policy or policy that can't possibly align with the reality of what schools are, why is this happening? And then for Matthew, I mean, he was running a school, and so he was trying to look at, you know, the frustrations of the narrative about how he implements change in his school and the reality about what his school is and how change could take place. So we ended up, you know, we didn't really know what the book we were trying to write was, but we really ended up trying to talk about why we don't know what works in schools and why it is so hard to affect change within the system. But most importantly, why do these fads emerge in the system, and why are they all ultimately destined to fail?
Yeah, I mean, let's dig a little bit then into the data bit. What are the problems at the moment in schools with regards to data?
Well, we see ourselves, I suppose, as in the dying days of the data wave that swept across schools in the 2010s. And we see that as in the book, we characterise that as a wave that emerged out of the failures of the wave before it, the personalisation wave, and this kind of need and demand that we must know exactly where each child is on their personal learning journey. And for many schools, that got enacted in the form of flight paths and so on, but also within an ever kind of more punitive accountability system, where we were trying to hold schools to account for what went on in their schools. We were trying to do it with data, and we were trying to do it with super short inspections, and therefore all the inspector ever did was went into schools and said, you know, show me your data to prove the kids are learning. So all of this emerged in the 2010s, and I suppose it reached its peak probably around, I don't know, 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
Where we'd got to the point where most schools were using tracking software, most teachers were being asked to input data into their software, and how that took place was different in different sectors, you know. So in primary schools, what was going on was completely bad, because it wasn't really even typing in test results. It was tick box stuff of can kids meet standards, and teachers having to input, you know, thousands of points. And then of course we saw a growing realization from the top that all of this was probably a bit of a waste of time, in the sense that there wasn't really any demonstrable route by which us all doing this was going to lead to children learning anymore, or indeed us being able to judge the quality of schools. And so the appointment of Amanda Spielman at Ofsted was a big point of change, because she stood up and made a speech where she kind of said, if somebody's asking you to input data into great big spreadsheets, you should ask, you know, ask for what purpose, who does the data help, you know, does it add value beyond talking to teachers and finding out what they think of the children. So she made that speech in 2019. In fact, we've named the chapter after the speech. We've named the chapter Great Big Spreadsheets. That, you know, that produced something of an about turn, I think, in the role of data, at least within policy. And just before that speech, I think that was the time when I was asked to chair a working group at DfE to try and write something about what constitutes good practice around data, particularly into the workload of teachers. And we wrote a report, which I think is okay. But it was interesting, the process of writing that report, because it made you realise, you know, how much was being done in schools without any sort of means of us saying whether this was effective or not. It wasn't like any research had ever taken place to demonstrate what should or shouldn't be happening. So we've got to a point now where, on the one hand, you know, I think policymakers probably think, oh, that's fine, you know, we've done data, we've said, oh, it's probably went a bit too far. But actually, when we do like surveys on TeacherTap app of like what's still going on in schools, the answer is there's still a lot of data practice there. And it's still there, either because the school leaders ultimately became true believers and they really, really do believe this stuff is useful. And it's really hard to change your beliefs, particularly when you've been asking your teachers to spend so much time doing it for nearly a decade, right?
Absolutely.
Or they just haven't got the message that, like, at the top there's been a change.
Well, I'll come back. I've got a follow-up question there, but just to say hi to Dr. Kaur, who's listening in from India. So she says, I'm new on this and I'm learning as I'm listening. Well, Good morning to you. And we're also joined by Leslie Ann, from Katie, from Jim, from Maggie. I'm just looking up the names. Lizzie. Yeah, so lots of people listening in live. Obviously, you can listen back to this as a podcast if you want to as well. Anybody who is listening live, all Teachers Talk radio shows are available as a podcast. Just before we go to the news and the ads, I just want to follow up there on that, but just to finish off on that issue of data is what is, you mentioned useful, that usefulness, right? What is an example of useless data? What's an example of data that schools shouldn't be using or is a complete waste of time?
Tough
question that, Becky.
Most data in a tracking system is useless data. And by that I mean that there's no means by which the data being in that tracking system is going to then feed back into a process by which you change what you teach the kid. The kid decides to learn more as a consequence of learning something about how they're doing. So it's, you know, to decide whether something's useless or not, you constantly have to think about the process of learning in schools and how the data informs that. And most data doesn't inform that at all.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, right? We're going to come back in a minute, Becky. I'm going to mute you now. Stay exactly where you are, please, if you can. Don't run away yet from my challenging questions. But yeah, we'll be back in 2 minutes.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. The government has announced plans to fund senior mental health leads training in all state schools and colleges in England. The training programme will help staff to promote mental health and well-being in their schools, to identify pupils who need support, and to work effectively with local mental health services for children. This funding comes in addition to the Wellbeing for Education Recovery Programme launched in August of last year. COVID cases in Britain totaled 31,564 on the 21st of September, a rise of almost one-fifth in a week. Deaths have also risen by 10%. The latest figures have been attributed to students heading back to school. Over 122,000 children in England alone were out of school for COVID-related reasons last week. The results of the Children's Commissioner's Big Ask survey reveals that 71% of 9 to 17-year-olds and 94% of 6 to 8-year-olds were happy with their life overall. The surprisingly positive survey results have led to the naming of current students as the survivor generation. Far from snowflakes, the Commissioner said, these young people have been heroic. That was your latest Teachers Talk Radio News.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people-pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course, or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses. All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Morning, morning, morning. We are back. We are live for the next 20 minutes. If you are not teaching, grab a drink, sit back and enjoy my final little chat with Professor Becky Allen about all things edu-fads and edu-geekery. Get ready for liftoff. We are live on Teachers Talk Radio. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at TTRadio2020.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/TTRadio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
So, Becky, we've talked about data, right? What are your other fads apart from data? What are your other things that you've kind of got a bugbear with apart from data?
Well, in the book, the other two fads we talk about are the big fads that we ourselves are experience. So one was the personalization fad, which took place around the time that the three of us were really at the start of our careers and, you know, trained to be teachers and so on. And then we talk about the current fad, which is perhaps the most controversial because everyone thinks it's a good idea, right? So we talk about the curriculum fad that's taking place at the moment.
I'm interested on that one. So with the curriculum fad, Becky, what do you mean by that? Tell us more.
What we mean by a policy fad is taking an idea and trying to amplify it into a movement, a policy movement that claims it's going to transform schools. So what we're not talking about is individual people with an interest in curriculum talking about within their own subjects how to make, you know, changes to the way curriculum is designed, or having debates about how curriculum should work, because of course that's a really important part of the education system, because our job is to write a curriculum and then try and help as many children as possible to learn it. So what we're talking about with it becoming a fad is groups of other actors coming on board and kind of trying to amplify its importance. And what we've seen in the case of curriculum is that people make these kind of overarching arguments that it's the curriculum that's going to be able to transform inequalities in society and ensure that there are not these differences in what's learnt between children from disadvantaged backgrounds and other children. So that's an example of the amplification that's taking place, you know, a stretch of what it's possible to achieve. And then there's people who are claiming that curriculum can fix the endless dilemma we have of measuring what's been learnt in schools, the problem of trying to assess what's been learnt by just saying assessment's easy. The curriculum's the progression model. We don't have to think about data anymore. We simply have to teach the curriculum and then tick off that we've taught it. And that informs our assessment model. So these are quite naive, I think, views of the complexity of really what assessment is in schools and what learning is in schools. And then, of course, you know, the collision with the accountability system that's taken place, so that now, you know, the focus of Ofsted, and it's extremely explicit focus of Ofsted, is that they are judging the state of your curriculum within your school as a really core part of their inspection process.
Well, it's the be-all. It seems to be the be-all and end-all at the moment.
It does, yes.
And my question, or my it's, this is me wondering, really, and again, I've been, as you probably well know, I'm not the biggest fan of Ofsted, or not Ofsted in particular, but any kind of slicing judgment mechanism of teachers or schools. I just don't think it works for education. But anyway, that's another side issue. My point would be is that an inspection team could come into a school for, say, 2 days, and they could have all these lovely conversations about curriculum with really smart and intelligent school leaders who know their stuff and can talk the talk and can use all the kind of buzzwords and everything else. But then what about behaviour? What about the things that are actually happening for the teachers and the students on the day-to-day in that school? Now, that you could argue that that's something that a 2-3-day inspection is never going to be able to ascertain, right? And I would buy into that argument. But if you are going to go down this route of team coming in for 2 or 3 days, oh, it's outstanding, the curriculum is outstanding, the curriculum enables learners, the curriculum does this, how can you know that from... They're going to argue,
right,
you can.
Ultimately, all we care about is the curriculum learnt or not? And we can't assess that by coming in and doing an inspection. I mean, I know that Ofsted have claimed they're going to be able to do it by opening the children's books and peering at what's in there. But that's a particularly unreliable, poor form of assessment of what children have learned. But, you know, there's other issues with the way that the movement has taken place. And I think for some subject groups, they love this curriculum movement that's taking place, because they work in subjects where maybe, like, the dilemmas and debates about what to teach when and why to teach it are particularly interesting and fruitful. But for other teachers, a lot of the debate and the narrative and the words that are being used are not as meaningful to them, and not as meaningful.
Can you give me an example of the subjects you're referring to? If you were to say, okay,
his teachers.
Oh, Becky, hang on a minute. Wait a minute. No, I'm actually agreeing with you. But what?
I mean,
what,
they love it. They love talking about ambitious history curriculum. They talk about it being an inch deep and a mile wide, you know, knowing, experiencing, learning, all these particular meanings within history. But, you know, the maths teachers are all sitting there listening to this debate going on and being told to be ambitious about their curriculum, teach to the top and everything else. And they think that this has no meaning. In fact, it's an actively damaging way to think about maths teaching.
Why, though? Why
because
is that the case?
In strictly hierarchical subjects where mastery is critical to progress, it's really important that you don't use phrases like teach to the top. Oh, it doesn't matter what the kids at the bottom know. I'm just going to teach really hard stuff and somehow suck them up so they learn, you know, the maths, because maths teaching doesn't work like that. You know, maths teaching has to take place at the point at which is appropriate to the child in terms of mastering concepts. I mean, that's very different than these cumulative subjects, where ultimately you can move on and you can try to encounter new ideas. And, you know, in the social sciences, the humanities are very much like this. And children can get something out of a lesson, even if they've learned nothing from the topic before or the lessons before. But that's just one example. The point is, the irony of the curriculum movement is you take a load of people who really care about their subject and the uniqueness of their subject, and then you pump them up into a movement where suddenly it's become incredibly generic. You have head teachers standing at the front of schools, or the assistant head in charge of teaching and learning, saying, we're going to do an inset on curriculum today, and as a part of this inset, you must do X, Y, and Z, to which you think, well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because, like, different subject departments have different knowledge structures that they're trying to build inside children's brains, and therefore entirely different conceptual ways of thinking about what curriculum is and the extent to which it needs to be designed within school. You know, so for example, in maths departments, like lots of maths departments buy off-the-shelf programs of work, and that's particularly true in the primary sector, but it's also true in the secondary sector. So are we now saying that they are bad maths departments because they've bought off-the-shelf things, because they have a head of maths who can't articulate like what the intent of the maths curriculum is?
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, because what makes maths teaching complex is very different to what makes history curriculum design complex.
I mean, that's an interesting point you made. I think the level of pressure on, because of this movement that you've talked about, this kind of curriculum movement, the level of pressure now on middle leaders particularly to kind of know everything and be able to really think on a really complex level about these ideas and these methodologies. Number one, most teachers who came through the teacher training system pre the last couple of years won't have had any training on this whatsoever. Mm. Secondly, you know, some teachers just aren't as academic as other teachers, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, every teacher's different.
They're just not as interested in these things. And that's actually okay because in many countries in the world, you don't design your own school curriculum. You take the curriculum, and it's the national curriculum, and it tells you what to teach. And the job of being a teacher isn't defined around being a curriculum designer. And we could force all teachers to be curriculum designers, and that you can only progress in the English system if you become an expert in curriculum design. We could choose to do that. But we have to recognise that's a choice, and it's an expensive choice to us in terms of like the amount of investment of those teachers' times, but also our money in CPD to make sure that they're able to do that.
What's the motivation? You mentioned groups of actors coming on board to kind of create this curriculum movement, right? What is their motivation for this? Is this just because they love their own subject? Is that what you're saying? Because to me, some of these people aren't actually in the classroom, so that doesn't necessarily equate to that, does it?
No, that's right. And I suppose within the book, we try to say that people come on board to a policy fad for kind of some reasons that are unchanging over time. So the reason why people have jumped aboard the curriculum fad are kind of similar to the reasons they jumped aboard the data fad and the personalization fad. And what we say is kind of a couple of different things. And one was we say there's some fundamental problems in modern schooling that mean it's not very amenable to being solved and fixed. And yet we need the system to be fixed. We need it to be better because we need it to fix the ills of society, essentially. Yeah. And the two big characteristics of modern schooling that make it a very difficult system to fix are something that we call the lockstep problem in the book. The idea that we have to place 30 children who are ultimately very diverse in their needs, in their prior knowledge and their capabilities to learn. We have to place them into a classroom together, and we have to cater for those needs simultaneously within the classroom. And it's not really possible for us to do that. And we probably should be upfront about that. But that's one of the challenges we face. And then the other challenge we face is that because of the invisibility of learning and the changes we're trying to affect in the brain, we can't ever develop any kind of consensus around the best way to teach things. But also that we're just working within this really complex system. And describing the education system as complex, what we mean by that is it's an interconnected system, it's interdependent, it has these feedback loops, it has long-run outcomes that we can't observe. We've got millions of pupils, teachers, policymakers all interacting with each other, adapting their behaviours to each other. And it means that when we try to do things within the system, the results tend to be quite unpredictable. They're not very deterministic. So, for example, we take a program, a new curriculum, for example, and we say we're going to implement it in 10 different schools. And what we end up with is 10 different versions of the program running, and we end up with 10 different educational outcomes as a consequence. So we just have this education system that isn't very amenable to there being these large-scale overarching solutions to fixing education. And we're constantly destined, really, to over-promise and under-deliver as a result.
And I wondered what you thought about this concept of the knowledge-rich curriculum. I mean, what does that mean to you?
So in the book, we don't really talk that much about knowledge-rich or the idea of powerful knowledge of Michael Young. And there are academics who write critiquing the idea of powerful knowledge. But again, I think, I mean, what we do say in the book is just, well, this is an idea that resonates very strongly in some subjects where it gives very clear steers as to what you should teach and you shouldn't teach. So I think we say in the book, we give one is a history example, which you'll like, you know, understanding the interrelationship between, say, the split of the Church of Rome with the Church of England as it became, and the lives of the personal lives of the Tudors, kings and queens. We say, well, that's powerful knowledge, and learning what sort of clothes Henry VIII wore is likely and would likely be characterized as not powerful knowledge because of what follows from what you can learn as a result. We also talk about waves, and we say, well, you know, in science, teaching the technical language behind what waves are and how to describe them, that might be powerful knowledge. Going down the beach, experiencing waves in person on the coastline, well, that might feel powerful as an experience, but I don't think we'd define it as powerful knowledge, which is not to say it's a good or bad thing to do necessarily, but the knowledge-rich movement would say, don't go down the beach, but teach about a wave in the classroom, because the experience, I think, wouldn't be characterised as powerful knowledge. Now, that's interesting to me.
Yeah, that is. Coming back to what you were saying is, and I guess it comes to the heart of why do the fads exist? And you mentioned about fixing things, and you know, classic is kind of like narrowing the gap between the achievement of disadvantaged students and the rest, kind of thing, right? And that's one kind of ill that there is that kind of obsession with fixing, and you know, I understand the reasons why, but is the answer to actually strip that away? Is the answer to just say, let's concentrate on trying to be good teachers / professionals and enjoy our jobs and do a good job, and that's it, rather than let's fix this particular problem?
If we don't fix it, who does? If we say it's within our gift to fix the problems of society, then we end up kind of killing the teaching profession. And that's, you know, I suppose that's the endless dilemma that all of us face, is that we don't want to be neglectful of the really tough circumstances that some children face in their lives and wanting to support them. And schools do an amazing job of supporting families because they have to, because there's nobody else there anymore. But we just need to acknowledge the burden that it has. And I suppose to some extent for the classroom teacher who's going in and teaching 22, 23 hours a week, you know, the reality of their lives is that all they can do is more muted. All they can do is focus on trying to think through what is it realistic for children in my classroom to learn and how can I support them in doing that.
And that's where I sometimes struggle, because I mentioned yesterday, tweeted yesterday about teacher burnout. I think it's going to be a huge issue this year. I think after events of last year, and then this year started full throttle for a lot of teachers, right? And I think if you're teaching, you just mentioned, you know, you're 20, 22, 23 hours a week, which, you know, is what the average, you know, full-time classroom teacher in the UK would do. It's to then say, right, fill in this curriculum documentation, or think about curriculum, or read this book on curriculum, or do this or do that. It is a bit, that is tipping, it's going to tip some over the edge, you know, and like that's...
Well, it's going to lead to a range of different behaviours. Yeah. Going back to the diversity of teachers, and in the book we describe what goes on in a school, and you have the teachers who it won't tip over the edge because they'll just take the form or whatever, they'll just scribble a load of stuff on it and they'll say they're done. And I kind of
it'll still take them
people.
Time though.
It will
it'll
take them some take time, them but they'll probably do it. In the book, we characterise the IT teacher who looks like they're taking part in the inset, but are really just like marking their coursework or whatever. And they'll just be sitting there and just type it in, write down, send it off. I mean, what's difficult is the teachers who will really, really labour over it are likely to be the teachers who are more inexperienced and haven't learnt to play the game of what we call in the book, like compliancy expertise, like yeah, on the surface. Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, head, brilliant idea. Yeah, I'm completely with you on this new initiative, but you don't actually properly do it. You just, on the surface level, you learn how to incorporate it into your daily life and manage it.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, yeah, I was talking to Danny Steele last night, who's going to record an interview for Teacher Talk Radio. But basically, he was saying, as a principal, he was saying that, and I loved it. He said, we got this thing from, I mean, he's in the States, right? He's a principal in the States. We got this thing from State Department that, you know, all the teachers had to fill in this professional development plan, whatever. And he said, right, he said to all the staff, I've written it. Feel free to copy and paste it in. Copy and paste what I've written. Send it to me, and then I'll forward it upwards, right? Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. I mean, he was basically saying anything that he doesn't think is important to the school, he's going to cut corners with, and he's going to support the staff in cutting corners on it. And I thought that was brilliant that he actually said to him, look, here's the template, just copy it into that and then send it back to me if you want. He said, like, if you want to write a big professional development plan, then crack on. If you don't, here's a format that you can use. Mm. I thought that was great. Anyway, that was a bit random, but you take my point.
No, I do. And it reminds us of what happened with the pupil premium and the need for every school to write their report and so on. You know, in the end, there was just a lot of copy and paste going on across the country of teachers just, or heads sharing reports and uploading them onto their website, and then we wonder why, like, the whole policy doesn't have any kind of effect. And it's actually because it's, you know, it's not really happening. It can't have an effect because it's not really doing things, is it?
It's also the issue of money as well, because the amount of money, you know, if you think about your three fads in the book, you know, your three key areas, there's a huge amount of money being ploughed into these areas, isn't there? That could be being ploughed into more teaching staff, as an example, or better wages, better salaries, whatever.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is another story altogether. Becky, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for coming on. Love the chat. It's great to hear your thoughts on various different things. The book, The Next Big Thing in School Improvement, is out in November, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it before that, actually?
I think it's the 22nd of October. So I think
22nd of October.
Yeah.
22nd of October. So everybody get on that. It sounds brilliant. Love the ideas in there. I'm certainly going to be taking a look at it. So thanks very much. And yeah, keep in touch. And hopefully chat to you again soon. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Cheerio. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Professor Becky Allen, and what a conversation that was. I know a lot of you have texted in. We've got Dale listening in from the West Midlands. Good morning, Dale. We've got Dr. Kaur, who's been listening in the whole show from India. Thank you, Dr. Kaur. Do get over to ttradio.org and subscribe on that on our site there, and get involved in the conversation with Teachers Talk Radio. We have shows every single day, and more shows coming up later on today too. So thank you to both Dale and Dr. Kaur for listening in today, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to Becky. Next week, God, I'm excited. God, it never stops, my show, in terms of the guests, the excitement I've got. Next Thursday, I've got Charlotte Whelan, who was the head teacher of the school, and I'm just going to say the school who did the whole, like, poetry video. You know, like last week, there was like the big, like, thing on edgy Twitter about school where the students recited poetry. So I'm going to be chatting to the head teacher of that school about how, why, and what the students recite, right? And why they're doing it, what happens, and so on. It won't just be about that, but that's going to be the key. That's going to be the big part of the conversation. It's talking about that because it blew up edgy Twitter. Like, this idea of the students in the morning lining up and reciting poetry. Dale has texted in saying, I worked with Charlotte Whelan during my NQT year in East London 2014 to 15. Wow. Well, I don't know Charlotte, Dale, but I'm delighted that she's coming on the show to discuss the big, like, thing. You'll probably have seen it, the video of the students reciting the poetry in the yard before lessons and lining up. And It caused a lot of controversy. You know, there were people saying, oh, this is terrible that they're being forced to recite this. There were other people who said the poem's wrong, like, you can't, it's not a good poem for them to recite. and so on and so forth, right? So it's going to be really interesting to talk to her about that and find out more. Also next week, not just Charlotte, but I've got Danny, the interview that I did yesterday with Danny Steele. Danny Steele, who you might know on Twitter, at SteeleThoughts, absolute hero. Love the interview with him. I've got part one next Thursday, and I've got part two the Thursday after. So you're going to be spoiled with a double dose of Danny SteeleThoughts. And honestly, not to be missed, because he's a legend. Like, so good to talk to. And so I literally wrote down a page of just, like, SteeleThoughts. Like, these kind of, it's like, inspirational, like, nuggets that I've kind of taken from that. A little bit like Becky today, to be fair. There was a lot that Becky said that I really liked, especially that last 20 minutes about curriculum. Goodness me. You know, I don't know whether, Dr. Cower, I'm a professor of education at university. The conversation was excellent. Many thanks. Well, thank you for that text in. I'd love to know where. I mean, do you want to call in, Dr. Cower? You've been listening to this whole show. It would be great. I don't know what you're probably busy in your faculty there, but put some headphones in and call in. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are, but both on the conversation we've just had. But if you're a professor of education at a university in India, I'd love to. Oh, dear, that's a shame. Busy right now, Dr. Cowell. But that, well, maybe another time. Maybe another time. In fact, maybe email me. Oh, goodness me. Okay. Well, you should email me. You should email me. And you should come on my show and tell me what's going on over there. That would be brilliant. Yeah, I'll put my email in the chat here, and you can drop me a line and tell me if you'd be willing to come on the show as a guest. Because I'd love to talk to you about Punjab University in India and what's happening over there. You're the professor of education at the university. And yeah, that'd be cool. So anyway. Back to the point. We have got lots and lots of Teachers Talk radio shows over the next couple of days coming up. So make sure you tune into those. We've got a couple more shows later. We've got loads of shows in the next 3 or 4 days. I think we've got like 20 shows coming up in the next 4 days, as usual. So make sure you keep tuning in. Teachers Talk Radio, live, as always. I'll be back next week.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.